You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 3rd, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from literally just outside Scary, Indiana, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Scary Indiana. One of the things I'm in charge of over at Crooks and Liars is making sure that Mike's blog roundup goes up every morning. And Ten Grain has been doing this week, our pal Ten Grain. And he said, look, I can't find any blog posts anywhere that aren't about Indiana. It has literally sucked all of the oxygen out of social media and the blogosphere. Just completely, there's nothing else to talk about. Even though we've got really important things going on. You know, we've got Iran talks, and we've got California water supply problems and really important stories going on. No one wants to talk about anything but Indiana. And we're going to talk about Indiana, but we're not only going to talk about Indiana, because I think a lot of what needs to be said about it has already been said.
Bill O'Reilly who?
Well, there's that.
Yeah, see?
He's been fully vindicated, Driftglass.
Yeah, I don't think that word means what you think it means.
I don't think it means what he thinks it means either. No, Governor Mike Pence. Let's face it. I think left the House of Representatives to become governor in order to go back to the White House or be vice president, because that's what you do. Yeah, that's the career track that is no longer available to Mike Pence, as far as I can tell. I think he's kind of blown that.
Wow. Yeah.
Spectacularly. Yes.
Yeah.
But you know, the story of Mike Pence will make a fabulous Broadway show.
I will write it. I'll write the book for that.
Broadway musical. Yes, it will.
He really has brought a lot of attention to his state. Mm. This in a certain way reminds me of, I've been going through my blog archives, and I'll talk about that in a little while, but it reminds me of 2007.
Yeah.
When the Bush regime was in full retreat on all fronts.
Yep.
When everything, this is after Katrina, after Terry Schiavo, after it was painfully obvious that the war in Iraq was in complete chaos. And the world sort of divided itself momentarily between the large number of people who were horrified and shocked and the small hardcore number, the 27%. Remember the 27%? 27% who just hung on like grim death. There was nothing Dick Cheney could do that was wrong. And everything was everyone else's fault.
That group has grown as the strategic forgettery that goes on in Fox News. It's now 50% of people who say, you know, George Bush was actually a really good president.
He was. And if only we'd stayed in Iraq and not let liberals destroy us and ruin the war for us. But Mike Pence is in that same sort of box right now where there are hardcore defenders. Every Republican candidate, as far as I can tell, has backed him.
Well, and that stupid-ass pizza parlor, Driftglass, that stupid-ass pizza parlor that said we won't cater a gay wedding, as if you'd cater a gay wedding with pizza, actually has made over $150,000 in donations from people for whom politics is just team sport.
Right.
And you just support your team. And we don't have that on our side. I mean, I'm grateful to our subscribers, but I got to tell you, this podcast, to make $150,000 would take, how many years would that take?
That is
over
zero
a decade.
To the number of episodes we've done. And that starts to get into that range there.
So
we'd have to do this for a decade.
You've done a blog for a decade and happy blogiversary. Yeah. We would have to do this for 10 years to at least to make that much money. So they just did it by being bigots. You know, I mean, that little inbred girl, white girl, who said, oh, well, you know, we're Christian. That's why. And anytime you ask these so-called Christian business people if they would cater a divorced person's wedding.
Yeah.
Well, they're all divorced anyway.
Exactly.
I made up my mind about that, I guess. And Newt fucking Gingrich weighing in on this.
I know. This is you and I are reading the audiobook. I don't know what the listening to.
Which a listener sent to us, and thank you very much.
We're slowly making our way through the Invisible Bridge, which is the Rick Perlstein's wonderful masterpiece, a biography of Ronald Reagan and the rise of Reagan, and the repurposing of a lot of stuff that he learned when he was researching Richard Nixon. And the idea, it's the movement from the Nixon-era politics to the Reagan-era politics on the right, what happened. And we'll talk a lot more about this and other things down the road. But I want to mention the thing that the pundits all got wrong, that Rick really documents well, is they never saw Reagan coming.
Mm-hmm.
All the smart people never saw him coming, because this is a period right after Watergate and Vietnam. When you had the country divide into factions. And one faction was, look, the White House was corrupt. The president was a criminal. Vietnam was a horrible mistake. Let's learn from it. And then you had a faction that said, no. Richard Nixon was a great man who was screwed by liberals. Vietnam was a noble experiment that failed because of lack of support on the home front. And everything is great. And this sort of complete iron dome of denial that anything was wrong and anything had happened on the right that was fucked up, it was all someone else's fault. It was all the liberals' fault. It was all the liberals' press fault. And the people who were the very smart people, who were, you know, the very serious people, laughed at that because, well, it's fucking obvious what the truth is. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. And along came Ronald Reagan, who embodied that sense of complete denial that anything was wrong, that anything had done, anyone on the right had ever done anything wrong. It was, and that's why nobody took him seriously until he started winning. And that's why I think Ted Cruz and people like Mike Pence, maybe not Mike Pence himself, but people who embrace that complete denialism of reality, and who find a way to navigate between the economic conservatives who want to punish poor people and the social conservatives who want to blame everything on abortion and gays. If you can sort of cobble together enough of a coalition to get through the primaries, you could win because there are enough people who are in staggering denial.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com. Nobody saw Reagan coming intellectuals.
It was impossible for them to believe that anybody could just whitewash the immediate past, what had happened just, you know, months or years ago, and was on every radio station, every television, Watergate summer, and just blithely deny everything. And that's what Reagan did brilliantly. He just pretended it never happened, or pretended it was someone else's fault, or pretended it was some larger conspiracy against which conservatives had to push, because it was all the liberals' fault. It was the liberal media. It was the liberal New York Times. And he said it with a very big smile and a sunny disposition and an aw shucks attitude. And the people who were who thought their movement was over, the conservatives who thought that's it, you know, we ran the table with Nixon,
screwed the pooch for the last time. And he had two advantages. Reagan did. One was the bicentennial in 1976, which really led to a sense of patriotism that a lot of people didn't expect it to. A lot of intellectuals in the New York Times and liberal media thought, oh, this is going to be about the failure of America to live up to its ideals with Watergate and Vietnam. And it turned out, no, it's going to be a marketing opportunity with red, white and blue. And it was an election year and Jimmy Carter won. Let's not forget that his one term started that year.
Yes.
And Reagan lost the nomination to Gerald Ford.
Yes, he did.
Who was really knee deep in Watergate. How could you pardon Nixon? That's what lost him the presidency. So, and then the other thing that Reagan had, I think, in addition to that bicentennial kind of etch-a-sketch, was he had those 4 years of Carter and the Iranian and his treason.
Yes.
Talk about negotiating with a foreign country.
Yeah.
Behind the president's back.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the thing that comes back to me over and over again when we listen to this book is everything is the same.
It really is. This is the great burden of being a liberal is remembering the past.
Yeah.
That's our job, really, when it comes right down to it, which is weird because, you know, the root of conservatism is to conserve, is to preserve, is to respect the past and respect traditions and respect what has gone before and be very incremental and careful about making any changes. But it turns out liberals are the ones who are now required to write down what happened. We're the Josephus of this country because we have to write down the shit that happens. Because if you ask a conservative any question about Reagan or Bush or Obama or what they had for lunch yesterday, you're going to get a completely fictionalized, delusional, unfact-based ideological answer, and which they believe with all their little hearts. They absolutely believe it. So these people have not just come to this church recently. No. It wasn't Iraq that drove them crazy. It wasn't the election of that black guy that drove them crazy. They were primed and ready for this. They've been doing this for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing it successfully for 30 years. And they do it by conquering their own memory, by willfully forgetting what just happened because it's too painful for them to face, and they just sort of march on. And there is that moment in The American President, which we just sort of saw on television 2 minutes of. They're not interested in your problems. They're interested in making you afraid and giving you someone to blame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's all they do. That is literally, you can take all American conservatism, all of it, economic, foreign policy, everything, boil it down to, their job is to scare the shit out of you and give you someone to blame. And that's all they do.
In our notes, imagine how the civil rights movement would have gone with Fox News and the Koch brothers and $1 billion spent against it. $1 billion spent against Martin Luther King. And there was moneyed interest against Martin Luther King, no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
But Fox News and the Koch brothers, they were not up against that. And so it is different in that respect. But a lot of this book, which I recommend, it's really good. It's Rick Perlstein, The Invisible Bridge, and it's about Nixon and Reagan. And it's a history lesson of our time, our life, the politics of what has happened in our lifetime.
And what we've done, what conservatism has learned to do is take the rough edges off and put polish on it. So you don't have George Wallace standing in a schoolhouse door.
No, you have Sean Hannity with the American flag behind him. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. And you have this and there's no rebuttal. Because once you control your own media, you don't need to rebut anyone because no one's watching what they say anyway. And you can get away with murder. You can get away with saying anything you want. So,
but see, that's the problem, though, for Mike Pence, in my estimation, is that people in the mainstream media, on CNN and on NBC, because of George Stephanopoulos, and I think we have to give a little credit where credit is due.
Yes, we do.
People are listening to everything Mike Pence says all day long. And so yesterday when he went on, he did a press conference for Indiana media and said, yeah, this needs fixing. And then the afternoon he goes on Fox Radio and says, this doesn't need a fix.
Yeah.
You know, 5 hours.
Yep.
He's flipping and flopping and flipping and flopping 5 hours based on where he is, who he's talking to, and thinking he can get away with it. And Nicholas, I'm sorry, I'm going to fry here. The guy from the New York Times, a columnist.
Nick Kristof
was on Lawrence last night. And he said, this is a huge problem because they really do think that they can talk inside this bubble and that all of their information can come from this bubble and no one's ever going to call them on it. And he didn't say Fox. He was really careful not to say the word Fox.
Uh-huh.
But if you're Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush, it was Jeb Bush, Huckabee, and Rick Santorum, and Marco Rubio, I think it was. No, Jindal. Excuse me, it was Jindal. All came up behind Mike Pence on Friday.
That's right.
You know, and 3 days later, that's a horrible mistake. And the only one that has flipped back and said, no, maybe we need to revisit this is Jeb Bush. Flip-flopping in 3 days. And he's going to probably get away with it this early in the campaign, especially since he has so much money.
Uh-huh.
But he won't get away with this in August of 2016. And if he does, he'll pull a Romney. He'll be saying the president never said terrorism, you know, and have to be corrected on a debate because all his news comes from Fox. He's going to be in huge trouble. Hello?
I'm nodding my head and wishing that were true.
Well, I know you are more cynical than I, but let's remember that Candy Crowley did correct Romney.
She did. Absolutely.
And I think it makes a difference in the swing states where people will come out to the polls if they think they're going to be a winner. And that's, you know what I'm saying? There are people who will only vote if they think their candidate's going to win.
I do.
Which is stupid. Which is really stupid.
But we're fighting a war on two fronts. Mm-hmm. We're fighting a war against the outright treason mm-hmm. and fraud that passes itself off every night as news on Fox and on right-wing radio. And that's just a straight-up toe-to-toe slugfest that no one's going to win because they have an infinite supply of tit-shaking blondes and Steve Doocy's they can just keep throwing into the arena over and over again. Roger Ailes is just going to keep grinding that because there's an audience for it. There's a definite corporate audience. He gives the audience what they want to hear. Bill O'Reilly gets caught lying. His ratings go up. Mm-hmm. That's how they operate.
Yep. And the pizza place makes an incredibly bigoted statement. And they get $150,000 for it.
Exactly. So there's a straight up fight there that we cannot win. We're not going to lose it. We're not going to win it. And the second fight is against the people who against George Stephanopoulos 90% of the rest of the time.
Yep.
Which is when Jeb Bush puts his foot in it. There will always be someone on camera, always be someone there. A Matthew Dowd, someone like that will always be there. A Bill Kristol, always there to say, yeah, but Hillary Benghazi emails. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so however badly the candidate fucks up after the primaries, there'll be a reset. And everything I said during the primaries doesn't count. La, 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 because we're not going to count it. There will be a lot of outraged people on whatever's left of MSNBC by that time. And I don't know that it'll look very much like it looks now, but hopefully it will. And there'll be a lot of outrage among liberals about, can you believe this bullshit? Oh, my God, he said one thing and then he said something else. But the real fight is going to take place at ABC, NBC, CBS. The real fight's going to take place at the Sunday morning talk shows. And at those shows, there'll always be someone there to diffuse what Jeb Bush said because something, something Barack Obama, something, something Nancy Pelosi. And
I'm really beginning to think about those shows that, first of all, nearly everyone acknowledges in the real world that those are wholly owned subsidiaries of the military-industrial complex. Sunday morning is owned by military contractors in terms of advertising, in terms of angle. And the only people that watch those shows are angry liberals and congressmen. That's it.
Okay. Well, there are a lot more people watching any of those shows on any Sunday than ever watch
us. Yeah.
That ever watch MSNBC or ever watch Fox. Yeah. I mean, there's just an order of magnitude difference. And there are plenty of people who get their serious news. You know, that's where they get their, you know, this is the rest of the news is blah, blah weather and it's sports and whatnot. But, you know, what's really going on in the country? I can tune in to Meet the Press and find out what's really going on. And I'm not saying everybody, but the smart set, you know, the people who are out here where we live, mm-hmm. who want to feel informed, will read a couple of international or national newspapers and watch those kind of shows.
Yep. They think they are informed. Up on the news. Yep.
And every time they turn, with a few very rare exceptions, what they see when they turn on is a pissing match, a polite pissing match between a conservative who says one thing, a liberal who says something else, except there's no real liberals on television. And just the sanctimonious centrist person, who's always a Republican, frankly, who's saying, you know, it's really both sides. It's always both sides. It's really the whole system is corrupt. The whole organization is corrupt. Isn't it a shame that both sides can't get along?
Well, see, that's why we really do need a challenger for Hillary.
Yeah.
Is because you need to have some sort of controversy on the left. I'm sorry, I said on the left. On the Democratic side. I don't mean the left. So that they have something to cover. Because right now, all they have to cover about Hillary is emails. So, you know, she should hire somebody to run against her. But you said both-siderism, Driftglass. And that segues beautifully into, I want to get on a little bit of hate for Essie Cupp. Because she made me very mad. And if that's her job, is to make liberals like me mad, then she does a good job. You know, I have to work on not reacting so violently to her.
You were watching on Fox News, right?
No, I was watching her on Bill Maher.
Oh, that's right. Bill Maher.
She was on the panel of Bill Maher.
Yeah, because that's only fair.
It's only fair. And Bill Maher didn't question her.
No.
But what made me so mad, because it could have been anything that came out of her mouth, but what made me so mad is they were talking about, and Bill Maher is actually very good on this issue of war with Iran.
Yeah.
You know, he really gets it that we are being incredibly stupid. And anyone that thinks that there's going to be any more military solutions with Arab countries is listening to the wrong people.
Yeah.
And so Barney Frank was on. And he said, look, you know, this is opportunism. Dick Cheney goes on the Sunday shows or goes on the talk shows anytime there's any hint of terrorism, whether it's real or not. So when an airplane crashes, there's Dick Cheney saying, look, this is terrorism. We need to go to war. We need to make sure that we're militarily ready to go to war with ISIS. And it's opportunism to do that. And Essie Cupp said, yeah, just like the anti-gun movement.
I'll
let that sink in for a minute.
Yep. Just think about that.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Anytime there's a shooting, those anti-gun people just come out and take advantage.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And so, that you know, I don't think it's her job to make liberals like me mad. I think her job is anytime they bring up the issue, anyone brings up the issue of Dick Cheney, Republican, lying us into war for money, her job, Essie Cupp's job, is to say, both sides.
Derail that conversation. Quickly.
Derail that conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's both sides because people who think fewer guns in the hands of crazy people who want to slaughter kindergartners are also taking advantage of the news cycle.
They really are. It's only fair to talk about the both sides. And then we're off to discuss the relative moral merits of...
No, we're not. We changed the subject.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because Bill Maher has a shtick he wants to do. I'm in the middle of a bit here. Mm-hmm. Burn in hell, Essie Cupp. I have no mercy in my heart for her, and that makes me angry with myself as a Christian. I will tell you that. I want to believe everyone is redeemable, but she will burn in hell. And anyone who says both sides about Dick Cheney and doesn't consider 150,000 dead Iraqis as part of the conversation, just burn in hell as far as I'm concerned.
I pray
for myself at this point, not them.
People like this spent most of the Iraq war hiding behind dead soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
People like this spent most of the time getting us into the Iraq war hiding behind the people who died on 9/11.
Yep.
They take tragedy and fear and death and leverage it into the political outcomes they want. Mm-hmm. And they're merciless about it. These are the people who every time George Bush went down the polls, suddenly there's another terror alert.
Yeah, right.
Who
Except
are absolutely
this time. Yeah.
And we just keep hitting that button. So Essie Cupp's job is to go on shows like this and derail conversations that throw murdered children on the tracks to derail the conversation from where it should go, which is why the fuck is anyone listening to Dick Cheney at all anymore?
Right.
And all I can say is if she'd done it once or twice, it wouldn't have any effect. But this is, you know, there's this, I hate to go all Doctor Who on you. There's this double beat thing that goes on in many episodes of Doctor Who as sort of the background noise to a plot device, which is the heartbeat of a Gallifreyan. And it's how we're going to bring the Gallifreyans back. And it's what the thing that drove the Master mad.
Doctor Who has two hearts.
That's right. And so there's a whole plot line around using this very simple tap, 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 tap code for very bad reasons. The background radiation, the background noise for our political discussion, the canvas on which everything has to be painted, is both sides do it now.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides do it. And one of the things that became really clear to me, you and I have been doing time traveling this week.
Yes, we have.
We have gone back, thanks to Rick Perlstein, to the good old days of Richard Nixon. And heard a bunch of names we haven't heard in a long time, like Howard Hunt and Maurice Stans and people like that. And I have been, since this is my 10th blogiversary and I'm fundraising, ruthlessly fundraising, I've been going through my archives, going back to 2005. And it is a weird sensation to read through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of your own posts and see, and you know how the story ends.
Mm-hmm.
And see how these trends are just blossoming. They just sort of develop overnight. And they're rigorously reinforced. So you watch the very end of liberals are monsters who want the country to fail and George Bush is a great and good man. You can watch the tail end of that die off around 2005. And suddenly, very suddenly, there's an entirely different narrative being pimped by exactly the same people who were Bush regime boosters just a year before. Suddenly, it's both sides.
Mm-hmm.
David Brooks is writing columns about Tom DeLay and the Tom DeLays on the left who are the Netroots people.
Wow.
And suddenly there's this because they were in trouble.
Yep.
The lie they used to pay for their houses, the mm-hmm. lie they used to justify getting lots of people killed and pissing away trillions of dollars, the big lie they all got rich sucking off of was dying off. And they were terrified
mm-hmm.
that people might come after them with pitchforks and torches because, frankly, Bill Kristol his head should be on a fucking pike.
Yep.
And if not, he should be nowhere near a television camera. He should be a pariah. He should be driven out of polite society. If he shows up in your town, you push him back to the wilderness and make him go away. Mm-hmm. Same thing with David Brooks. Same thing with Tom Friedman. Right down the line. Those people have no business.
At the very least, it should be brought up that they were horribly wrong over and over and over again.
Occasionally. It would be nice if someone would bring it up. So watching... sort of, it's like a little flip book, you know, a little cartoon flip. Watching the both-sider lie blossom out of the corpse of the liberals are wrong, George Bush is right. Well, how do we, suddenly you have a bunch of people whose job it is to comment on the world, whose world is coming apart.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you rip off the liberal critique of George Bush? How do you rip off liberal vocabulary and avoid acknowledging that liberals are right all along?
Addition to both sides, Drift Glass, it got so bad they had to go to the no labels.
Yeah.
They had to break glass on no labels.
Oh, this is the original architects of this were people like David Brooks, who was like, there are three parties in America now. There's the Democrats and the Republicans, and there's the McCain-Lieberman party. And why can't we have the McCain-Lieberman party?
Just erase the Bush party completely.
It never happened.
Never happened. Hey, Driftglass.
Yeah.
It's time for Bible Bit.
Bible Bit.
That's not scriptural. It segues just so beautifully into what you've been saying. And you think looking back on 2006 and seeing same as it ever was is astonishing to you.
It is.
You go back to the book of Jeremiah. I've been reading this week.
Speaking of time travel,
mm-hmm. This is Jeremiah 5 and 6.
Now, for those who don't know what Jeremiah is, give them a little.
Oh, well, Jeremiah is the word Jeremiad, which means, you know, accusation, bitter accusation against society, comes from this book. That's what this is. This is an indictment of the time in which Jeremiah lived. And it goes on and on and on. I'm only going to read a little bit of it, but you want to be here for this. And think about George Bush being a good Christian man.
Yeah.
Which they actually also said about Nixon. I mean,
yeah,
this is the amazing thing.
Huh?
You know, he's a good patriotic Christian man and really wanted to do right by America. The liberal media destroyed him. Okay. But this is Jeremiah. My people are infiltrated by wicked men, unscrupulous men on the hunt. They set traps for the unsuspecting. Their victims are innocent men and women. Their houses are stuffed with ill-gotten gain, like a hunter's bag full of birds. Pretentious and powerful and rich, worse, they have no conscience. Right and wrong mean nothing to them. They stand for nothing, stand up for no one, throw orphans to the wolves, exploit the poor. Do you think I'll stand by and do nothing about this? God's decree. Don't you think I'll take serious measures against a people like this? Unspeakable, sickening, what's happened in this country? Prophets preach lies, and priests hire on as their assistants, and my people love it. They eat it up. But what will you do when it's time to pick up the pieces? Everyone's after the dishonest dollar, little people and big people alike. prophets and priests and everyone in between, twist words and doctor truth. My people are broken, shattered, and they put on band-aids saying, it's not so bad, you'll be just fine. But things are not just fine. Do you suppose they are embarrassed over this outrage? No, they have no shame. They don't even know how to blush. There's no hope for them. They've hit bottom, and there's no getting up. As far as I'm concerned, they're finished. God has spoken.
Wow.
There you go, David Brooks.
Yeah.
George Bush, good Christian man. Yeah. Huh. So, full Jeremiah this week. Eh?
Yeah. Wow. Oh. Wow, that blew my ears back.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is an ancient condition.
It is.
This is an iteration of an ancient condition. And what is maddening about our version of that very, very, very old story, I think, is that we have access in real time to the lies they told last month.
Yeah. And more so with social media than ever before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we can, I mean, I can click on, I can, you know, with five mouse clicks, I can find the David Brooks quote where he says one thing. And then a year later, I can find him saying exactly the opposite and swearing that he never said what he said to begin with. And it should be at that point as easy. And then, believe me, there's a lot of this. This is just litters his writing and everyone else's, frankly. In theory, it should be as simple as, well, he's lying. Here's one thing. Here's the other. Why are you putting up with this? But the people who make those decisions have walled themselves off from the rest of us.
Well, and I want to talk for a moment about the update to the story of the governor of Maine.
Uh-huh.
And Stephen King, because I don't know how you solve this problem. This is the problem where the governor of Maine clearly said that Stephen King moved to Florida to avoid paying Maine taxes, which was not true. And Stephen King has made a lot of hay over this on Twitter and elsewhere. And so what happened this week, Driftglass? How did the governor of Maine respond to finding out he'd said something that wasn't true?
His staff scrubbed the archives, scrubbed
the transcripts.
And he said he never said it.
I
never said that. I just said he was out of the state. That's all I ever said. I never said he didn't pay his taxes. And his minions just barbered history, just shoved it down the memory hole. And it never happened.
And so now we're talking about Indiana and we're on to something else. And I don't know how you solve this problem, because now he's a Republican governor and they'll never be mentioned on Fox News, where the news that the Republicans watch, that he ever said that or ever any controversy about it, or he was ever stupid.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no fix to the base of the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
As we have time traveled this week. They've been around forever, mm-hmm. and they will continue to be around forever. They are a constant pestilence. They're an accompanying disease. They're a social disorder. They're something that will be with us always. Like the poor, they'll be with us always. What you can do is contain that, as opposed to embrace and celebrate it. What you can do is starve that, mm-hmm. as opposed to feeding it and then using it for political advantage. There, as I've said many, many times, there is no hope at all in getting conservatives to stop doing this, because there's no profit in it for them. There's no upside to admitting that I'm right and you're wrong. There's no profit in saying, holy shit, my entire life I've been led around by my dick by liars. And look how stupid I am. Liberals are right. I was wrong. Oh, my God. How did that ever happen? There's no profit at all in that. So you're never going to get them to admit that or acknowledge that. And there's no road for them but deeper and deeper into darkness. They cannot stop going down that road, because the alternative is complete psychological meltdown, a complete acknowledgement, you know, a road to Damascus kind of moment, where they suddenly realize, holy shit, I've been wrong my whole life. And that happens from time to time. But I wouldn't bet the swing states on it.
Yeah, yeah.
The alternative, literally, and I bore myself saying this, but I'm going to continue to say it anyway. The only way to approach this problem is to go after the people who are the enablers of those people. The people who say, yeah, but Democrats, yeah, but the liberals. That's the only breach in the wall. That's the only place you can focus your fire. So you're never going to get the governor of Maine to admit that he lied. You're never going to admit David Brooks to admit that he made shit up, that he reversed himself and re-reversed himself. The money is too good. The money at selling this both-sided bullshit is way too good for those people who have ever been. But they're the people who actually have to straddle that reality line. The people who live in Fox World never have to face reality. They never have to talk about how horrible. They're worried that Barack Obama's coming for their guns. They're going to put them in a FEMA camp and make their kids gay. That's their world that they live in. So, and there's no way into that world. There's no way out of it. They're just stuck there until they die. The people who are vulnerable are the people who actually have to straddle the world of reality that you and I live in and the Fox fantasy landing, so come up with constant equivocations why both sides should be honored, both positions should be honored, both. This is about religious freedom. Can't we all be tolerant of everybody's opinion? That's where you go after them. Now, I don't have nearly the firepower to do that. Neither do you. But I'll bet you if 3 million liberals wrote to the New York Times every week and asked, why the hell is a congenital liar like David Brooks on your staff? Mm-hmm. And asked every time one of the owners of that paper came out in public or sat down in front of an audience, insisted, no, I have, why is David, why do you put a liar like this? Here's ample evidence of his fraud. Why do you keep putting him on television? Or an easier target would be Bill Kristol. Bill Kristol is a full-time employee of ABC News. And I'm, again, going through my archives, going after the media for Bill Kristol being permitted in front of a camera goes back 10 years. You know, I find shit in my archives of me and liberals generally being incredulous that this person who has fresh blood on his hands is being put in front of a camera being treated like a serious person. But he has something on these people. It's either the club he's in, the church he goes to, the family he was born into, or some other leverage he has that no one outside of that club is ever going to talk about. But for some reason, Bill Kristol gets to smirk over the people he has caused to die and be wrong about everything and be welcomed back in front of the camera next week like a visiting sage. And someone in that organization has made that affirmative decision. Now, I can't fix that, and you can't fix that. But again, I'll bet you if 3 or 4 million liberals cornered George Stephanopoulos at a coffee shop and started cornering people who work at ABC News where they lunch, and started demanding very loudly in every single at Coe's, at Atrio's, right across the board, of every liberal outlet, including MSNBC, you fucking cowards, started demanding to know why the hell the producer, insert name here, hired this grotesque liar and put them on the air. I'll bet you could force them to answer that question. I bet you could pry an answer out of them. I bet you could force them into a Mike Pence type corner where what you have done is so fucking indispensable or indefensible rather, mm-hmm. that the only thing that your indefensible decision lacks is context. Mike Pence, the context came right along with you. You pissed off the NCAA. You threatened tourism.
When Walmart is on the side of...
Exactly.
You know, the other... When Walmart is on the other side, you're in trouble. Yeah.
And that's the context.
Anybody who thinks that, oh, look, liberals like Walmart now because they're going pro-gay. No, we're saying, look, Mike Pence, if scumbags like Walmart are taking the moral high road against you, mm-hmm. you're in trouble. Big trouble.
So the Mike Pence could have done everything he did, but there is a context that the marketplace created that made what he did completely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And the only way to fix this problem, since there's no way to go after the base, is you build a context around specific individual hiring decisions, specific mm-hmm. individual programming decisions in the center. The people who are sworn, who have sworn on the life of their children and their bank account that they're never going to hold conservatives responsible for anything, that it's always going to be both sides. Build a context around people like that mm-hmm. and demand to know how they can continue to be the wheelmen, the enablers for such awful gorgons, such awful monsters like Bill Kristol. Kristol's a big target and an easy target.
Yep.
And that's where I would start. If it were up to me, if I were in charge of, you know, if I were the commander of liberal, you know, Kristol Mountain, I'd say, look, everybody, we'll fight about all the other shit we want to fight about later. We want to fight about marijuana reform or drones. That's great. We should have long arguments about that. But let's all agree, shall we? Can we all agree on this one thing? There's no place for a scumbag like Bill Kristol on national television, period. He should be on Fox News, where he was fired from, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Or he should go back to the Weekly Standard.
He's been fired a lot.
Yeah. Well, he was fired from ABC News.
And the New York Times.
He was at ABC in the 90s.
He didn't do any homework, and he got fact checking wrong to the point where the ombudsman had a problem with his column, because it's like, no, you can't just say stuff that just is fact-checkingly easy to prove wrong.
Well, and it was a long, I mean, he was at ABC News.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on that show, and they kicked his ass to the curb because they couldn't stand him anymore. And then he went on to the Weekly Standard. They went on to Fox. He got a job at Time Magazine. He followed David Brooks over to the New York Times. He has a miraculous magic power to cause people to hire him, even if it's only for a year, in the most prestigious jobs in America, where he fucks up and no one ever asks him the obvious question, what the hell are you doing here? And he seems like a really clear, big target you could go after. If, in fact, liberals could stop infighting for 2 minutes and say, look, we're all going to sing from the same hymnal now. We're all going to go after this one guy. And we're going to demand to know why the hell this proven fraud and liar, this bloodthirsty monster, is on television. Answer that question and create the context for asking that question. Create the context wherein the person who has to answer that question is ashamed to answer it.
Yep. Well, and I think I want to just end here with the thought that Elizabeth Warren shared with Rachel Maddow in a, you know, the orgasmic moment for liberals of the week was when Elizabeth Warren was on Rachel Maddow. Oh, my God. She talked about progressives and liberals and Democrats and all those people that want to win back the Senate. And we know it's going to take a long time to win back the House. But putting the wind in our own sails, and the way you do that is issues. And I really think that Hillary Clinton needs to be joined at the hip throughout this entire campaign by AARP, by this group called the Leadership Council of Aging Organizations, which is this umbrella group for Social Security, the elderly, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And this election needs to be about Social Security, needs to be about student loans, needs to be about fracking and labor and minimum wage and clean air, clean water, clean land. And let's no excuses about you're not a scientist, you assholes.
That's right.
Happening. California has run out of water. Shut up. And you take those things and over and over and over again, that's what you're talking about. Anytime somebody brings up Benghazi, you talk about Social Security. Anytime somebody talks about emails, you talk about Social Security. And that will, I do believe, snap some seniors out of the Fox News bubble. Because they do recognize, in the end, when they have to, if it's threatened, where that check comes from and who has the power to cut it.
And when you have someone with a big megaphone who can pick up your issue, I mean, let's face it, the reason nobody talks about global climate change on the Sunday morning talk shows
is their sponsors are oil companies.
One, their sponsors are oil companies. Two, there's no way to turn this into a both sides argument and not look like a complete fucking idiot.
And not look like an idiot. Yep, you're right.
And
you're
the
right.
Only topic the only thing we're going to discuss are things that we can parse down the middle and invite our conservative friends
in. The horse race. Yep.
But the people who can change that context are liberals en masse. We changed that context for a few months in 2005.
Yep. And we
could do it again. And a person with a big ass megaphone. I agree with you 100%. If Hillary Clinton's asked about emails, she says Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
If she's asked about Benghazi, she says Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And talks, it just sticks to her issues and insists that we talk about this and refuses to take any questions about anything else, whether that's fair or not. But it is long past time for us on the left, I think, to write off the right. Don't ignore them. Don't pretend they're not there. They're like global warming. They're really there. They're very dangerous. They're getting worse every day. But there's no way to persuade people. As I wrote in my blog this week, I made a strategic error out of thinking thought experiments could persuade people who are proud of the fact they don't think.
Right.
So
right.
You're not going to reason these people back into the real world. They're gone. They cut them off. But you can go after the people in the middle, the people who enable them, the people who diffuse your power and your energy and your focus by deflecting in every different direction, by refusing to talk about the fact that the right has lost its mind.
Mm-hmm. And I love your analogy of the packaged product, the TV dinner that is handed to people who want that to be their food. They want Fox News to be the news. It confirms all their biases, and it's exactly what they want to hear, and they're going to sit down in front of it, and by God, they're going to hear it. And then there are those in the middle that know that TV dinner is shit. Right. They know that's not real food. They know that's not good for them. They know it's full of salt. They know it's crap. And they know the difference between a decent meal and a TV dinner. Whether they experience the TV dinner from time to time, they know that's not real news. Mm-hmm. And so those are the people that you have to snap out of this, well, both sides bullshit, because they are the ones that deep down inside know. And the fact is, everybody inside the Beltway knows that Fox News isn't news. Oh. They just won't say it because of money.
And if I could add one thing that's actually in our notes, it was one thing we lack on the left is a deep throat inside.
You're right.
There's nobody. Imagine how Watergate would have been different if there were no one on the inside telling Woodward and Bernstein where to look and what to look for.
Yep.
And whether they were right, whether they were wrong, whether the right track or wrong track. Mm-hmm. There is nobody inside the mainstream media, as far as I can tell, who is willing to talk off the record about what's really fucking going on inside and why Bill Kristol has a job, why David Brooks still is employed, why Tom Friedman, anything. There's nobody willing to leak that. And which is weird because, you know, journalism is about leaks. It's about telling what's going on. And really, until there is some breach in that wall.
Well, until there's someone that's willing to be poor for the rest of their lives like we are. I actually emailed a friend of mine about that because of, you know, there was a conversation on email about social media and somebody getting caught. Oh, the new host of The Daily Show, that's what it was, saying, you know, supposedly anti-Semitic things on Twitter and supposedly the X, Y, and Z on Twitter. And saying, you can't say anything anymore. You know, you can't have any failed jokes on Twitter. You can't have anything on Facebook if you want to get hired to be on TV. It will just cause you nothing but trouble. And I said, that's why I've definitely made the decision that I'm never going to have a job again outside my own home for the rest of my life. Because there's just no, I can do this or not. And I want to thank everyone who has contributed to our podcast over the past month. It's hard to go to the mailbox here at home and be fearful of finding another bill that we're figuring out how to pay. But it is fun to go to the P.O. box and see wonderful letters of encouragement and contributions and hear that what we do means something to you guys. So thank you. Mm-hmm. And we're writing back when we can. And if you haven't heard from us yet, just know that we really deeply appreciate your support, both moral and financial.
May I shamelessly promote my blog?
You may shamelessly promote your 10-year-old blog.
I got this blog that goes on over there, over at driftclass.blogspot.com.
Where you write every day.
I write every day. This is the thing that I can't talk about this person because Lent is not over yet.
I can. Are his initials AS?
Yes, they are.
Is he British?
Yes.
Is he gay? No,
he's American, honey.
Well, he's American now.
as apple pie.
Is he a Thatcherite, former Thatcherite?
Yes, he is.
Gay. He's a gay conservative.
Yes. And I'm not going to.
I think I know who you're talking about.
I'm not going to critique his life or his thoughts or his work or anything.
You're still on Lenten diet until Sunday. That's right.
Absolutely. But the idea that, you know, I worked at this every day. Well, you didn't really. You took a month-long vacation. And you took another vacation. You took breaks.
Yeah, there was a comment from that person that blogging was going to kill him.
Right. And you know
and
what?
We did have a hey-ho and hearty laugh at that.
We did. And this is a blogging thing. No, this is a writing thing. And take it up with the ghost of Isaac Asimov. If you want to talk about writing every goddamn day, he wrote every day for 50 years.
Stephen King has been a little bit prolific too.
Yeah, Stephen King writes a book in the bathroom. No, I mean, so I'm sorry, but if you're a writer, if you're a serious writer, you get up and you write every day.
Yeah. There have been some comments from a lady on your blog.
There was a lady named Blue Gal who was flirting a little bit. And in retrospect, it's clear to me now what she was up to. And
I was constantly telling you that I wanted to marry you.
Yes, you were.
In a joking kind of way.
But
that really was. I was completely not thinking along those lines. I thought that you were and I don't mean this in the Lindsey Graham sense of the word. I really did think that you were a confirmed bachelor, that you were...
Well, I was.
Never going to get married again.
I was. Right up until I wasn't. I was.
Right
that's,
up until
that's
you
the way
went,
that works.
You know, I've been thinking about it all of a sudden.
You know, this is kind of working out pretty good.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was it went on. We flirted. We met.
And a certain Indiana woman named Shakespeare's sister introduced
us. She did. We hit it right off. We'd hit it off virtually. We hit it right off personally. Mm-hmm. And we decided, hey, this is kind of fun. This is interesting. We should, you know, of course, it's never going to go further than friendliness because, of course, you know, you live far away and I have up here and I'm a confirmed bachelor after all. Everyone knows that. And this is where calendars fly off the page and things changed and I evolved. And it turned out that this is where I'm a bigger and better man than David Brooks. I can admit when I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out I was not a confirmed bachelor. I got that completely wrong. I never thought I'd be a dad and now I'm a stepdad. I never thought I'd live in central Illinois, and I live in central Illinois. I never thought I'd be married again, ever, ever, ever thought I'd be married again.
Well, life takes unexpected turns sometimes, and sometimes
it does. It does. And honestly, reading through 10 years worth of posts, daily posts, it is really interesting. It's not quite autobiographical, but it really, I mean, my brain is wired funny. I remember vividly things that I did in a writing group 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the names of people I met at a party an hour ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just, that's the way I'm wired. So reading these things through sequentially and skipping over, you know, stuff that's redundant or stuff that's quick is fascinating because there really is a narrative arc there. There really is a story there. And each year is sort of a chapter. So what I'm doing on my blog is I'm sort of making the framework of what might be someday a small book or a small pamphlet or whatever it is. But there's this history, there's this story that I've already written. And then you can see the point at which I start fundraising because suddenly I'm unemployed. And then you can see the point at which I start writing about local politics because I'm free to write about local politics.
Whereas you were not before.
And obsessive interests iterate themselves, trends come and go. The period when Steve Gilliard passed away is
that was a hard time, very hard time.
Times when it was really hard to write, when I wasn't producing anything, times when I had incredible prolific output. But it's interesting. It's probably not interesting to anybody else, but it was interesting to me to go through all that and see all the places that we as a community, as liberals, have gone over the years. Mm-hmm. What has changed? What has remained completely consistent?
Yep.
What the baseline of our enemies look like through time, mm-hmm. and how little that has changed, and how much fun it's been. Even though it's exhausting, even though it's, you know, but you're a writer, you write every day. So that's what I'm doing. I'm writing every day.
Well, and now, I think about, I don't know if there's a political lesson here, but I do think about the time when I discovered that you had kind of changed your mind about marriage. And I was talking to you and just saying, you know, I accept the fact that you aren't interested in marriage. I just don't understand why my life has gone this way, where I was married to the wrong person for a while, and now I've met the right person, and that person doesn't want to get married. And I don't know, and, you know, I will be satisfied with that because I have to be, but you are the right person. And you looked at me and said, well, I've been thinking about marriage too.
Who said never? Hope never happened.
You did not pull a David Brooks on me. I will say that. You said, you know, I have been thinking about it and I have changed my mind. And
if I may put one.
And many tears and embraces followed. Yes.
It was a happy revelation.
It really was right out of a Jane Austen novel. It was just like, oh, my goodness.
And the rest is just
the two get together after all. Yeah.
Oh, it worked. Oh, great. And it was, and you know, our families get along and.
Yeah.
Everything. And suddenly I'm a dad. Like I said, I'm a dad. And who knew that I've been preparing for that job all my life?
And you're their dad. You're their stepdad. They take ownership of you. It's not just all of a sudden I'm a dad. It's like all of a sudden I'm a stepkid.
Yeah.
And they fell right into that role in a very wonderful way. Yeah. So
and I would like to plug one because just to let you know, I'm raising money at my blog.
Yeah.
I'm shaking my tin cup at my blog. I'm doing a fundraiser. That's part of the reason I've done this long-winded thing. And I'm doing samples. I would just like to put in a plug for a post I'll be doing today or tomorrow, because I'm doing a year a day. There was a time, there was a column David Brooks wrote in the New York Times where he completely forgot about the existence of entire genres of music.
Yeah.
Just
this is so funny.
Just pretended they weren't there. He made some big, you know, social, because his arguments are all very abstract, very abstruse, very floating above the earth in high earth orbit, looking down on us peons, speaking from a godlike third person perspective of how humans behave down on the planet below. And it was he was drawing some high moral lesson from music. I'm not going to give it away, but he was drawing some lesson about how modern music is this certain way, and it never was this way before. and to believe, and I'm like, wait a minute, what? Are you fucking kidding me? To believe that, you have to pretend that gospel and blues and country music and mm-hmm. Western music never happened. And I was kind of astonished that you had made such a staggeringly stupid statement. Then I realized, well, no, that's all of a piece.
Yep.
David Brooks has spent his career pretending Iraq never happened, pretending he never wrote about divorce being a bad thing or broken families after he got divorced, has written whole tracts, whole magazines full of articles that he just disavows and moves on and pretends they never happened, because there's no cop on the beat. There's no one around to tell him he can't do that. So why not just, if you're not aware of those things, or you got up and you were hungover and shit, I got to do the column real quick. Let's talk about how women are in music these days. There's no assistant. There's no one to tap them on the shoulders. Nobody to hold them accountable. So I had completely forgotten this thing had ever happened, but it made me laugh when I found it. So I will be incorporating it into my big ass fundraising thing for the next day or two.
Thank you, Drift Glass.
My pleasure, Blue Gang.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Suki. Suki used to live in the country where there were small rodents and birds, and Suki was often an outdoor cat. But Suki recently retired to the seaside, expecting she would enjoy the fish. But she discovered that between her own self and the fish, there were many large, aggressive seagulls.
Oh, crap.
So now Suki spends more time indoors than she used to. She doesn't like the seagulls. I don't blame her. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Drift Glass, we are overdue for a letter show. We really are. We need to get to that. Before the summer, we're going to have a letter show, I promise.
Uh-huh.
Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast and help pay our electric bill and cable bill and internet bill with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. So, Drift Glass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, no offense, but the internet kiddies never thought for 1 minute about ordering redneck pizza for their wedding.
Let's think about living. Think about living. Let's think about loving. Think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Drift Glass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Drift Glass.
Science Fiction University is from our friend Raymond. Thank you, Raymond, for sending us some Science Fiction University questions. First of all, Drift Glass, an essay question.
Ah.
A Robert Heinlein essay question.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which Robert Heinlein juvenile would you like to see made as a movie? Most of them, Raymond thinks, would be either done by Disney and thereby ruined,
uh-huh.
or are just too old or outdated to make it.
Yeah.
Raymond thinks that Starman Jones could be made well by someone other than Disney.
Uh-huh.
Have spacesuit will travel, comes close, but he's worried that it would be Disney-fied if they made Have spacesuit will travel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I would like, I'm not sure if it's a juvenile. I think it's a juvenile. I would like to see Glory Road made into a movie.
Oh.
Glory Road is Robert Heinlein's trip into sword and sorcery, but he does it via science fiction.
Ah, okay.
I think it'd be very adaptable because it involves a war veteran, a young war veteran, basically taking his time getting home.
Mm-hmm.
He's broke. He's very proficient with weapons. It's a lot like Dr. Watson.
Oh, okay.
He's extremely proficient with a sword for some reason. And other weapons, and he is unemployed and probably unemployable, and he's essentially living off $10 a day on a beach in France, slowly making his way back to the United States, and a boring ass job that he's never going to like. He's approached by he answers an ad in a local paper about adventure, wanted, essentially a lunatic to go on a crazy adventure with me. And he is propelled into the heart of galactic politics and a beautiful woman and a terrible villains and great allies and high adventure. I think Glory Road would make a fine movie for that crowd. And it has it's science fiction at its heart. It's about the theft of a device that makes essentially the governing of the galaxy possible.
So it's got a MacGuffin. It's got stuff that's very cinematic. Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
And it's about, it's a swashbuckler because he swings a sword.
And he's free and easy. So yeah. And then he meets a beautiful woman. Oh,
he meets a beautiful woman who is also the queen of the seven galaxies.
Oh my God.
Whoa. What? Yeah. What?
You just spoiled it for everybody.
No, I didn't spoil it for anybody. I think Glory Road, because there's so little, travels to Mars, that ain't gonna happen. I think it would actually be a better science fiction story because it doesn't take place in places where we know there's no water, there's no air, there's no likelihood that you're going to be there anytime soon. Yeah,
cool.
I got to work. Yeah.
Well, now Raymond has sent us some science fiction questions, and I have tinkered with them a little bit.
All right.
Because these are all questions about doctors in science fiction. But I decided to remove all of the Doctor Who questions and add a couple other ones just because those get kind of obvious. And I decided to make it hard on you.
I just say that's like taking the Eisenhowers and Kennedys out of Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah,
it's just not fair. and Hemingway's. Oh, is it Hemingway? Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, it's Ernest Hemingway. All right.
So
I'll do what I can.
These are clues to doctors in various science fiction outlets. Here we go.
All right, go.
And number one is a gimme. Which science fiction character often started sentences with "I'm a doctor"?
Oh, that would be Leonard Bones McCoy.
That's right.
I'm a doctor, not a physicist, Jim.
Jim, that's right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Number two, this Robert Heinlein doctor tended to suddenly yell "front."
You wouldn't know him as a doctor, but it's Jubal Harshaw.
Yeah, Dr. Jubal Harshaw, actually.
It's one of the protagonists of, not the protagonist, but one of the main characters from Stranger in a Strange Land. Who's also a lawyer, who's also a writer. I believe he makes most of his dough off of writing, like Robert Heinlein did. And he keeps a bevy of extremely smart, very talented young women on premises who have multiple other talents, including dictation. I mean, they're doctors and scientists and God knows what all else, but he also puts them in rotation because he dictates his stories to them.
Ah.
And when he wants to dictate his story, he yells "front," and whoever's next comes up and writes down what he wrote.
Ah, front.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. This one is sort of could be seen as science fiction or not.
Okay.
Who is the literary father of Horton and Sam?
Oh, my favorite doctor. Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel.
That's Dr. Seuss, yes.
Dr. Seuss, yeah.
All right, number four. Who says, "Please state the nature of the medical emergency"?
that's your hologram. That's your emergency medical whatever it is.
Hologram, EMH, emergency medical hologram, right.
Hologram from Voyager.
Right.
You're stuck way the hell out in the D quadrant, whatever it was, and you got no access to anybody. So you're stuck with a hologram for a doctor.
She didn't want, this is number five, she didn't want to be known as the dancing doctor again.
Oh, this is another star. This is Dr. Beverly Crusher. Dr. Beverly. Yeah. Will Wheaton's mom.
Yeah. Star Trek The Next Generation. You know all of these pretty well.
Shut up, Wesley. Shut up, Wesley. Yeah.
Number six. Which doctor was astonished by 1.21 gigawatts?
That'd be Doc Brown.
That's right.
Doc Brown. Yeah, good old
Back
Doc
to the
Brown.
Future. All right. Number seven. This Asimov doctor tended to analyze robots.
Oh, the remarkable Susan Calvin.
That's correct.
Who they screwed up in the movie, because Susan Calvin was never a hottie.
Oh.
Who was hankering after Will Smith's wankering. She was absolutely not that at all. But she was a staple in the in his robot series.
iRobots, yes. All right. This doctor, number eight, helped build the $6 million man and the bionic woman.
Oh, geez, Raymond, man. Have a little pity. I know his constant companion and sidekick was Oscar Goldman.
Yeah, but that was not the doctor that created them.
No, it wasn't. I can see him there, sort of in the scene. I just can't think of his name. So
it's Dr. Rudy Wells.
Rudy Wells. Oh, Rudy. Dr. Rudy. Yeah. In fact, I saw an episode that featured Rudy Wells recently on Nostalgia TV.
Nostalgia TV. He was always being kidnapped.
and being, well, build us a bionic man. No, I'm not going to do it.
No. All right. Number nine. Shortly after graduating from medical school, he left Earth Force and spent the next 3 years hitchhiking aboard starships, trading his services as a doctor for free passage to their destinations. And it's not Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
No, if it's Earth Force, it's Babylon 5.
Yeah.
And, Jesus, what was his name? I can't think of his name.
Dr. Franklin.
Franklin, that's right. Dr. Franklin seemed to not have a lot to do on that show. I remember the face of the actor very well, but he always seemed to be standing looking concerned.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was there for, I think once he got put in peril or was kicked out of there or left, he was a lot more interesting, but he was kind of a boring character for that for a while. So,
all right.
Sorry, Mike Straczynski. It was a boring character.
Number 10. He was a heavy smoking doctor who delivered Athena's baby Hera.
Oh, yeah. I love Doc. Doc something or other. Doc something with a C. I don't remember his name, but he was, that was Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. Dr. Cottle. C-O-T-T-L-E.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He just hated everybody. Yep. He put a cigarette out on your wound. He would stitch you up. He had no time for your bullshit. And because, and you got to figure, he had a really, really rarefied skill set, which is why he got to have cigarettes and almost nobody else did. So, yeah.
Number 11. This doctor was genetically modified, liked to pretend he was a secret agent, and chose his job for the opportunity to practice real-life frontier medicine.
It got me.
It's Dr. Julian Bashir from Deep Space Nine.
Julian, man, that makes sense. Star Trek, every ship had a doctor, so I guess we're going to go through them.
Genetically modified, yeah.
Yeah, and he was, too. I remember
genetically modified.
He was upgraded.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. This doctor tended to say, "We're doomed," or "Come along, William," and he also tended to insult mechanical help.
Now you got to do the voice.
We're doomed.
We're doomed.
Come along, William. Yeah. Come along, William.
Sorry. Yes. Sorry. It's not. We're doomed. Could be anybody. It could be a character from Gulliver's Travels. But no, that's Dr. Zachary Smith.
That's right. From Lost in Space.
Who transformed from an actual villain into a comedic sidekick.
He was supposed to be kind of a Russian.
Yeah,
in the pilot, he's a Russian stowaway, basically. Well, Russian sympathizer.
I think I'm not sure if we ever say Russia. I think he's with the Reds.
Yeah.
We're not sure which country, but he's a saboteur. He stows on board to destroy the ship. He's definitely a bad guy.
Yep.
And then we discover that he's cowardly and weak and they turned him into, and that was what drove the actor, I can't remember his name, who played the father.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, because he was a serious actor. He played in other things, but he was a legit actor, and it turned into the Dr. Smith and Will Robinson show.
Yeah. Yep.
And which scary planet is going to threaten them this week? And it was just it turned into a joke, which is a shame because it had potential. But yeah, Dr. Zachary Smith.
All right, number 13. His only constant companion was a hologram, as he was hurtled here and there trying to make right what had once gone wrong.
Oh, Dr. Samuel Beckett.
That's correct.
Quantum Leap.
Quantum and, Leap.
That could be brought back as a movie, probably. That could be a movie. I don't see why not. It's got time travel. It's got morality plays. It was, you know, a lot of them were, you know, meh, okay. The last season, it sort of went wildly off the rails when we needed a supervillain, because eventually you're always going to need a supervillain. But I like that show.
Number 14.
Okay.
He has to bust his sister out of the academy where she's being experimented on.
Oh, that's River Tam's brother.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I'll accept Dr. Tam.
Dr. Tam?
Dr. Simon Tam.
From Firefly slash Serenity.
That's correct.
I'm one of those people that came to that series in the wrong order. I saw the movie first and then caught up on the series afterwards. So my understanding of it is all ass backwards. But yeah, he was a good character. He was a little too, jut-jawed and pure for my taste. Again, doctors are boring for some reason. Dr. Cottle, not boring. But a lot of boring doctors along the way. But yeah, good show, good guy.
All right. All right. Here's a quote from a doctor.
All right.
Someone asked the doctor, "Now, wouldn't that necessitate the abandonment of the so-called monogamous sexual relationship? I mean, as far as men were concerned?" Yeah. Regrettably, yes. But it is, you know, a sacrifice required for the future of the human race.
Okay. I would believe that would be a German doctor.
Yes, it's a German doctor.
Who came to this country to help our missile and nuclear deterrent program.
Yes.
And was confined to a wheelchair up until the very, very last possible minute. And that would be Dr. Strangelove.
That's Dr. Strangelove, yes.
I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed. 40, 50 million dead, tops. Oh, that's a wonderful movie.
Number 16, this good doctor is called into town to look at the uncle of the cousin of his ex-sweetheart, who somehow seems to not be himself as of late. This 1950s movie ends with a very dramatic breaking of the fourth wall.
Jesus. So it's a movie.
It's a movie. It's a 50s movie.
Oh, I should know this.
The doctor turns to the audience, turns outside the fourth wall and says, "You're next. You're next."
Oh, okay. Well, it's Kevin McCarthy. Not the evil congressman Kevin McCarthy, the good actor Kevin McCarthy. And that would be the original and best, still by far the best, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Raymond. I thought this was a good one.
Yeah. Well,
nearly all of them, but
in honor of the NCAA, we did a Sweet 16 this time.
Yeah, we did. We did a Sweet 16, and we'll be back next week with some more Science Fiction University. I love you. Bye.
I love you very much. Bye.
Okay. Bye.